Coming up on Philosophy Talk, the philosophy of John Rawls.
Suppose you were designing a state from scratch. There's going to be a butcher, a baker, and a candlestick maker. We have to decide who gets paid how much.
How can they do that fairly?
Rawls says, go behind the veil of ignorance.
Make them decide before they know which role they're going to play.
Justice as fairness. Equality.
John Rawls and a liberal tradition. Justice was the centerpiece of John Rawls' philosophy.
Justice and the difference principle. When are inequalities okay? How do we decide?
Our guest is Joshua Cohen from Stanford University.
The philosophy of John Rawls.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk after the news.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything
except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Today, the philosophy of John Rawls, one of the most influential political philosophers of the 20th century. Rawls articulated a vision of the liberal state focused on the principle of justice.
Rawls' most significant book was probably his Theory of Justice. Continuing the ideas of Locke and others, Rawls maintains that the best way to think of the state is as the result of a social contract. Think of the beginning of our Declaration of Independence. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by the Creator with certain inalienable rights. And then here's the important part, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. It's that last idea that governments are instituted among men, or humans at any rate, for a purpose. And so the powers of government are limited by this original agreement or social contract.
But unlike our founding fathers, Rawls doesn't argue that they come from God as the source of right. The social contract theorists in the modern tradition say that the control that the state has over its citizens and the control citizens have over themselves somehow comes right out of that social contract.
And they don't necessarily think of the social contract as an actual event. It's a framework for thinking about what's fair and just. What would people agree to? What control would they agree to cede to the state? And what would they reserve for themselves if they were forming a state?
And Rawls's vision of this social contract has this really special twist. He thinks of the deciders, the people negotiating the contract, that they should operate behind what he calls the veil of ignorance.
But Ken, that's weird. Usually if people are negotiating an important contract, you don't want them to be ignorant. What's the point?
Well, it's a very clever idea that Rawls has that's designed to ensure that the contract will be fair, that the participants will negotiate in a disinterested way.
Disinterested, not uninterested. Disinterested meaning having no stake in the outcome, like a judge should be. But if the negotiators are ultimately governed by the state they're creating, they will have a stake in the outcome. How can they possibly be disinterested?
Well, that's the really clever part, John. Well, it's going to take a little setup to explain how clever this is. We can talk about the roles people will be playing in the state after it's constituted. But for illustration, let's just suppose there's going to be butchers, bakers, and candlestick makers.
That's sort of cutesy, Ken, but go on.
Well, these negotiators operating behind this veil of ignorance, they have to decide who gets what kind of role and what rewards and benefits go with this role without knowing which role they're going to play. So the negotiators will try to figure out a system so that whatever role they eventually end up playing themselves, they can be sure of being treated fairly. The candlestick maker will know that his candlestick making salary and candlestick maker duties are something that he has agreed to as fair before he knew that he was going to be that candlestick maker.
Well, I think if I were negotiating behind the veil of ignorance, the safest thing would be to say that everybody should be treated the same, equally. Everybody should have the same salary, the same hours, the same voting privileges, absolute equality.
And, you know, and Rawls thinks that way, too, to a certain extent. The principle of equality, as he calls it, is the first principle of justice. And with respect to political rights, voting rights, property rights, and things like that, there are no exceptions.
But Ken, you said to a certain extent. What's the qualification there?
He's got this second principle, what he calls the difference principle. According to this, for example, certain jobs can get higher salaries and other benefits as long as those people getting higher salary and benefits works to the advantage of everyone, especially the least well off.
Tell me more.
Well, look, imagine that being a butcher or being a baker is something easy and lots of people would do it, you know, and you don't have to incentivize. And being a candlestick maker is really hard and onerous and nobody really wants to do it, but the society can't survive without the candles, right? So you say, well, look, what's what we'll do? We'll pay the candlestick makers a little more, and that way not just the candlestick makers will be better off, but everybody else will be better off too because we'll get our candles.
Well, that makes sense, Ken. That explains why you and I get the big bucks. We have this long apprenticeship to become wise, and then we do all this tremendous good for society. But I'm not sure it works with investment bankers.
Well, yeah, I'm not sure about that either. You know, there are lots of details and problems and criticisms of Rawls's theory. And to help us with all this and to tell us about the major objections and the major applications, we've got one of the major political philosophers of the 21st century. That's Stanford's own Josh Cohen, a man who actually studied with John Rawls.
And we hope to get our listeners engaged, too. The number to call is 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917.
And how well does the United States measure up to Rawls's ideas? Our roving philosophical reporter, Zoe Corneli, asked everyday people what they think. She files this report.
I approached a lot of people in downtown San Francisco and asked them all the same question. Do you think the distribution of wealth in the United States is fair? The answer was the same every time.
No. I don't know. I just think the rich stay rich and the poor stay poor. That's how it is.
Heck no. It's been getting worse over the last 8 years in particular. But I think for longer than that, it's been getting much worse. Distribution has been getting more and more polarized.
Fat cats get fatter. And, you know, there is no Robin Hood figure in our world right now, you know, regardless of who you voted for.
Research shows the income gap in the United States has been widening for decades, and it's been growing faster in recent years. During the presidential campaign, then-candidate Barack Obama got a lot of attention, positive and negative, for telling Joe the Plumber he wanted to redistribute wealth.
Your new tax plan is going to tax me more, isn't it?
It's not that I want to punish your success. I just want to make sure that everybody who is behind you, that they've got a chance at success, too. I think when you spread the wealth around, it's good for everybody.
So how does that play on the streets of San Francisco? April Ricafort says it's a nice idea, but...
I mean, how is he going to do that? He's not going to go into rich people's pockets and take their money and give it to other people. So he must be magic if he can do that. I mean, I hope he can do it. That'd be cool.
I think Barack Obama, he has a whole lot of ideas. I just hope he could really just put them into fruition.
Mark Andrew is hawking his rap CD to passersby, but he takes a break to speculate on what a fair distribution of wealth would look like.
There's a lot of people that are rich and they don't give back and they would just want to keep their money. Like, they want to make their money. I mean, I feel them, you want to just give your money out to, like, a random person that's not going to, like, you know what I mean, do something, but it's kind of like we got to think of the greater good. So I feel like professions that have people that really affect society, I feel like they should get paid a little bit more. I think teachers are like on the spectrum, they're like kind of high, the highest up, I feel like, because they directly affect kids.
To Barbara Forsberg, fairness means taking care of the neediest in society.
I guess my main concern would be that there be a certain floor below which people are not allowed to fall. And if people want to work harder or, you know, go above and beyond for their own individual gain, good for them. But below a certain level, it's not good for society.
Joyce Wagner says she and her husband have worked hard to build their own wealth.
He was a missile engineer, and I raised four daughters. And since we were raised in the 30s, we were frugal, and we lived within our means, saved for our future, and we feel that we certainly have earned our wealth.
She says now at 78 and 80, they are financially secure. And while they've always gladly paid their share of taxes,
we certainly don't want to give up everything we have because we did sacrifice for it for people who think, well, I'll get mine whether I do it or not.
Maybe the only way to get a truly equitable distribution of wealth is to eliminate it altogether. That's what Sam Bossen thinks anyway.
In a perfect world for me, I would say that there wouldn't be money and there wouldn't be like a hierarchy and there wouldn't be like a this, that, and the other thing, but that's not going to happen.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Zoe Corneli.
I'm John Perry. With me is Ken Taylor.
And our guest today is Joshua Cohen. He's a professor of political science, philosophy, and law at Stanford University. He's a prolific philosopher, written all sorts of things. But right now, he's recently paid homage to his teacher, John Rawls, by being a contributor to a forthcoming critical edition of A Brief Inquiry into the Meaning of Sin and Faith, Rawls's undergraduate thesis. Josh, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Nice to see you guys. I don't get to see you enough around campus, so it's good to see you here.
Absolutely. Yeah. So Josh, John Rawls was one of your teachers. Tell us briefly a little about him and how you got interested in political philosophy and John Rawls.
Starting with the latter, myself, I was interested in politics before I was interested in philosophy. I grew up in the United States in the 50s and 60s and believed in American ideals, country conceived in an idea, liberty dedicated to a proposition that we're all created equal, didn't think the country was living up to its founding conception and dedication. Somehow through connections with a few very interesting people who happened to be around Yale when I was an undergraduate, I got interested in philosophy as a way of pursuing the disparity between principles and practice in the United States. I decided to go to graduate school in philosophy. Rawls was then teaching there, and I think as everybody who came into contact with him knows, he was not only a remarkable philosopher, but a remarkable person. Remarkable in two ways, I think. First, he really lived the idea that you show respect for people. So you came there to study, and he treated you like an equal member of a community of inquirers right from the first day you arrived. And also, equally important along with the respect, was that there was a kind of moral seriousness about him. He really thought that the issues that he was working on and that other people working in political philosophy were working on were incredibly humanly important, and he conveyed that seriousness to his students.
A great teacher as well as a great, great philosopher.
Yeah.
Now, Josh...
A great person.
A great person.
A remarkable person.
Let's start on a positive note, if we can. Take one American institution, if you can think of one, that really exemplifies Rawls' theory of justice, and explain his ideas in terms of it, if you can.
Briefly.
Why do you keep saying briefly? Rawls had two principles, a principle of equal basic liberties, equal political and personal liberties, and then a second principle, which included an equality of opportunity idea and a fair distribution of resources idea. So the first principle said that people should have equal basic political liberty, equal political liberties, and equal liberties of conscience and person. I think it's fair to say that the United States does okay and has done better over time. Moral arc of the universe is long, but it's turned toward justice. It's done better over time on that first principle. It's an extraordinary achievement to establish equal basic political and personal liberties
especially,
for all people.
Especially if you look at the trajectory of American history. I mean, people started out with slaves, women couldn't vote, all this stuff. Yeah. You know, and that, it's true. I mean, so I think in that sense, America looks a little like a Rawlsian state, a Rawlsian liberal state. What about economic equality and inequality?
There are two issues there. One is the equal opportunity idea, and the other is the fair distribution of resources idea. I think better on the equality of opportunity, although not great, and on the fair distribution of resources idea, I'd say kind of a disaster. The last 35 years, or 38, who's counting?
Yeah.
for a long time, things have not been going too well. On a fair distribution of income.
And I think it's especially important that our income inequalities don't benefit the worse off. It's more like the better off exploit the worse off, and that's the deeply anti-Rawlsian thing. But you're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're discussing the philosophy of John Rawls with one of his premier students, Josh Cohen from Stanford University.
If we were to fully implement Rawls' vision, it seems like there would have to be more equality and less differences in American life, especially American economic life. Would this really be a good thing? Tell us what you think. Join us by calling toll-free 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Or you can email us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
Equality and difference, plus your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
are we all just everyday people? Nobody special? That's kind of what John Rawls proposed. Do you think America falls seriously short of Rawls' vision of justice or not? Tell us what you think. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor, and this is Philosophy Talk. John Rawls talked about putting people behind a veil of ignorance and deciding upon the constitution of the state in a way that you wouldn't know who you're going to be, where you're going to be in that whole society, whether you're going to be one of the winners or the losers or whatever. If you were behind a veil of ignorance, would you have agreed to our current economic system, for example? The toll-free number is 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917.
And you can email us at comments@philosophytalk.org. Our guest is Stanford's Josh Cohen, who was a student of John Rawls.
So, Josh, I want to go back to this economic inequality thing. Here's a kind of Republican argument. Economic inequality is good because it's an engine of economic progress, because you let the investors keep all their goodies, and they'll invest more. Help me think about this economic inequality in Rawlsian terms. Do the Republicans have it right or wrong or what?
Not right. But important to understand why. You know, there's an old idea that Plato had, which is that the gap between the top and the bottom shouldn't be more than 4 to 1. Rawls didn't care about the gap between the top and the bottom. The one thing that his difference principle tells you to focus on is how well off is the least advantaged group doing, say, people who live in the bottom quintile. And what he said is justice requires that their lifetime expectations be as high as they can be. So if you have tax policies and transfer policies, you want to make sure that you can say to people in the least advantaged group, you know, if there was more inequality, you'd be doing worse. If there was less inequality, you'd be doing worse. That's the only thing that matters,
so
how well they're doing.
There's a level of inequality that optimizes the well-being of the least well-off, and that's justice requires that?
I think that's a fair statement, but don't worry about the gap. Don't worry about the median. Don't worry about the dispersion. Only worry about one thing, how well off the least advantage you're doing.
But on the other hand, if you had good empirical evidence, I think we do, that a ratio of 10 to 1, say, really gets top-flight people into CEO positions, because that's about as big as it gets in Europe, then the 1,000 to 1 ratio we have here really isn't justified, even if these people are doing a pretty good job at job creation.
Absolutely. It's not justified, because what you're trying to do is not just get a little bit to trickle down. It's, are you doing as well as you can for people who are in the least advantaged position?
No, let me just help me understand. Okay, I'm a little slow. Okay, so
yeah, I know.
We've got. Is it that in absolute terms? So there's relative well-being.
Yeah.
And there's absolute well-being. What are we trying to maximize here?
Absolute. Not
well-being.
Relative. Right. Don't worry about relative.
Right. Because, well, what's the reason for that? I mean, this is supposed to be a principle of justice. It's supposed to be something about what rational calculators, self-interested calculators, would choose in this kind of constrained choice situation.
So you're in this situation, and you don't know where you're going to end up. You don't know whether you're going to end up at the top or the bottom. And what you care about is doing as well as you can wherever you end up. So, in effect, what the original position with the veil of ignorance tells you to do is imagine that you're buying an insurance policy and you're trying to insure yourself against doing badly. What you want to do is make sure that that bottom situation is as good as it can be. It's downside protection insurance policy, just like you have on your house, Ken.
But now, when you talk about as good as it can be, are we talking about just economics, or is there some idea of happiness or well-being behind Rawls's philosophy? What's going on there?
As good as it can be in economic terms, but and not happiness or well-being, that's your business, what your goals are in life and how you adjust those goals and make something of your life given what you're entitled to. But very important idea, Rawls thinks that the idea of maximizing for the least advantaged in income and wealth is a way that you show respect, This is how you establish a society based on the idea of people showing respect for one another, is that you don't have people who are better off doing better, even better, and people who are less well off doing worse than they could do.
So go back to some of our Zoe Cornelius' subjects in the Roving Philosophical Repeats. They said all kinds of different things, but one of them, I recall,
they all
said,
sounded pretty good.
A lot of them sounded pretty good, but one said, we worked really hard to get what we've got, and we don't really want to give it up to, you know, I believe in fair taxation, but I don't really want to give up what I've got to, and what I've earned and what I deserve. I mean, there's a view that the fruits of my labor and talent should be mine. If I've got more labor, more talent, then the state taking it away and giving it to somebody with less talent and less efficiency, that's somehow illegitimate. I mean, how does Rawls answer that?
I listened very carefully to that person because I think she was expressing a strong and common sensibility. I thought it was very interesting when she got to the end of her comments, and what she was particularly resisting was being taxed for the sake of people who are not working and not trying hard. Rawls's idea was, people who live in the bottom quintile in the income distribution are people who get up every day. They get on the bus and they go to work. They work a 40-hour week. It's not people who are sitting around and lolling around. It's fully participating, cooperating members of the society, and they're not getting a fair shake.
So how realistic is this in the American context? I have a little quote here from Warren Buffett, the great American businessman. I think this was a quip, not something he said from the heart. But he said, the fundamental principle of American business is if your competitor is drowning, stick a hose down his throat. Now, in this intensely competitive environment, because does this Rawlsian picture of mutual respect really make a lot of sense?
Warren Buffett is talking about how you treat competitors in the market. The United States isn't just a market. It's a political society. There's a political culture, and there's a division of labor. I think Rawls expects people who are competitors in the market to act the way Warren Buffett describes. When we operate as equal citizens and we're trying to decide on laws and policies, we're animated by different principles and ideals. His principles and ideals were focused on that problem of how we treat one another as equal citizens.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the philosophy of John Rawls, one of the great political philosophers, the great political philosopher of the 20th
century. And remember, Warren Buffett supported Obama.
We'd love to have you join this conversation. The number to call is 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. Or email us at comments@philosophytalk.org. And we've got a caller on the line now, Judd in San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Judd.
Hey, listen, I just want to tell you I'm the founder of one of the oldest hippie flower tribes, the Carista tribe, and we've been working on this whole thing for years and years and years. So, and of course, your program, Philosophy Talk, is one of my favorite programs.
Cool.
So I just want to tell you that what you're talking about today is totally relevant. It's the timing is just absolutely right. So I want to congratulate you all, and I'll be in touch with Josh Cohen and tell him what we're up to here.
Okay, Judd, thanks a lot.
Appreciate that, Judd.
Was Judd calling from San Francisco or Bolinas?
No, that was from San Francisco. But Josh, okay, so look, you said lots of things there, and I want to challenge this a little bit. Suppose if I were a utilitarian, this thing about respect.
Yeah.
Here's one of the things that's always bugged me about utilitarianism, but I want to know.
Just say what utilitarianism is again.
The greatest good for the greatest number principle, basically. So here's the thing that you could do if you were a utilitarian. You could make the worse off, that one-fifth quintile, as bad off as possibly could be, because if you have a bunch of exploited labor, it might maximize the well-being of the society as a whole, right? Why? What's wrong with that? What's a philosophical objection that Rawls has to that?
I think Rawls's idea is, let's step back from the issue of the distribution of income and wealth for a minute. And now let's apply the principle that you were just applying, not to something controversial, contested distribution of income. Let's apply it to religious liberty. You think it's okay there too? You think it's okay that if you have a religious minority and you wipe them out or keep them enslaved, or a racial minority, you wipe them out or keep them enslaved, that's okay? The refutation, I think, Rawls thinks of utilitarianism doesn't come from looking at the distribution of income and wealth. It comes from looking at our most fundamental moral and political convictions in areas about political democracy, the rule of law, religious liberty, personal liberty.
So does Ross think there are? Does he agree with Jefferson that they're endowed by their creator with quote inalienable rights? I mean, is that a starting point that you have to believe in these inalienable rights that are just basic to being a human being and come with the turf?
Well, you said a number of different things there. Let me focus on the endowed by the creator. I think what Rawls thought was that in a modern liberal political society with a diversity of political and moral and philosophical convictions, you look for some common ground of political argument. And you don't base your political argument on an idea like being endowed by the creator with inalienable rights. But you do end up with a principle, the first principle of justice, that says that you do, in effect, have inalienable rights. You just don't bring in the creator. Not that you deny the creator, but you just don't need it.
So if there are people who are at odds with one another,
yeah,
like the Nazis and the Jews or something like that, or the Hutus and the, right, or whatever,
Tutsis, yeah.
Tutsis, Tutsis. And they don't have this respect for one another that goes with this, are they missing something like just this basic fact about each other? Is there some fundamental deficit of rationality or insight, or what would Rawls say about all these people who are at odds and don't share this respect for one another?
I think Rawls thought of his political views as addressed to in the first instance, to a tradition of political life and political thought in which people accepted a set of basic ideas about treating one another as free and equal. And there's a huge conflict within that tradition, conflict between the more classical liberal and more egalitarian elements in that tradition. And he wanted to try to address that conflict. I think it's a somewhat different issue when you get to people who are fundamentally at odds with one another. And there, a different kind of argument may be needed. And it may be that an argument that talks about fundamental facts about human beings and being endowed by their creator with a kind of human dignity. But his argument, I think, is not addressed to a political circumstance of that kind.
Now, some philosophers, I think of David Hume or Zhuangzi in China, have had this idea that although humans are not really just naturally good, they do come in terms of human psychology with this ability that can be fostered and developed to have sympathy for other human beings, that it's as natural as other things. Is there a kind of a moral psychology like that underlying Rawls's vision?
Yes and no. Let me focus on the no part is not so much sympathy. The yes part is the assumption that people have a capacity for a sense of justice, that is, to treat one another fairly. I say not sympathy because it's not just that you identify with and feel bad for the pains of other people. It's that you respect them as agents, not just are concerned with them as suffering patients.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the philosophy of John Rawls with one of his premier students, Josh Cohen from Stanford University. 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. And Charles in Berkeley's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Charles.
Hi. I got a question. Suppose you have a benign dictator who doesn't subscribe to many of Rawls' principles, but based on his own personal desires and his desire to remain in power and not be threatened by others, keeps incomes at a fairly equal level and has a fairly equal society, why would you need these principles of Rawls in that case? And what isn't it the actual result that you're interested in? And in that case, why would the principles be necessary?
Take it away, Josh.
That's a very good question. And the short answer is it's not just the result that you're interested in. People in the society have this, as I was just saying, say a capacity for a sense of justice. We don't need a benevolent dictator or a malevolent dictator or any kind of dictator at all to help guide us in achieving a fair society. So there's an insult to us as free and equal persons, as politically moral agents, in the supposition that we need a dictator to help us to achieve fair outcomes. But it's not all about the outcomes. It's about the process, too.
Erica in Oakland's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Erica.
Hi. My question is more related to the economic, the distribution of wealth issue. And about kibbutz, the kibbutz model in Israel. And one question is just sort of generally, how does this fit in with this philosophy? But also, more specifically, I lived on kibbutz in the early 1990s and found a vast difference between the people who were older, who had founded the kibbutz in the 1920s, who had been very idealistic about equal distribution of wealth and kind of Marxist principles about labor and contribution, and then their children who had been born there and raised in this environment, and their children who had totally different, much more materialistic acquisition, I want to get more money because I work harder kind of an orientation. And I wondered if it just seemed like this was sort of a model that sounds nice but isn't sustainable based on kind of natural human tendencies.
Thanks for the question, Erica. So Rawls worried about stability.
Very good question. 2 points in response. First of all, you can always count on children to spoil the designs and aspirations of their parents, as in the case that you mentioned. Secondly, my understanding, and it's very limited, I'm sorry, of the kibbutz model, is that it's much more small groups, solidarity, and equality. Rawls, as I was saying earlier, is not opposed to inequality. What he's concerned about is that the least advantaged do as well as possible. Now, you describe that, Erica, as an idea about redistribution. I describe it as an issue about fair distribution, not redistribution.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing the philosophy of John Rawls with Josh Cohen from Stanford University.
So what do you think? Is Rawls too much of a lefty? Too much of a righty? Is he not sufficiently committed to equality? Does his veil of ignorance really make sense for a society in which people have such diverse religious convictions and political views as they do in America? Or in the world as a whole, for that matter?
Rawlsian principles and pluralism, plus your calls and emails, when Philosophy Talk continues.
A vision of everyone working together. One way to see the writings of John Rawls. But can Rawlsian liberalism work in a pluralistic society, in a pluralistic world? I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, and our guest is Josh Cohen from Stanford University.
Josh, we've got an email that raises some interesting issues for our third segment. This is from Tim, who's getting to us through the great Comcast network. And he raises 2 points, really. Clearly, equality and sustainability are linked. The investment class at this point seems only concerned with maximizing this quarter's profits regardless of the consequences. Meanwhile, the environment, natural and social, are destroyed. You can do it for a while, but eventually those without water, air, money will have nothing to lose and revolt. So we've got two things. Now, Rawls wrote before the environment was such a big issue. So how does his work fit with environmental concerns and also the international thing? I mean, we might have a just society in America that meets the difference principle and the equality principle, but by making it work, we may be screwing up the rest of the world. So how did Rawls come to think of these concerns?
He didn't really have very much to say on the environmental issue, although it's interesting that the listener connects the environment issue with the inequality issue, and he did have a lot to say about the inequality issue. And insofar as unfair inequalities are, you know, terrible for the environment, Rawls does have something indirect to say about them. But I think it's a limitation of his view that he doesn't really have very much to say about the environment. On the global issue, the last book that Rawls wrote was called The Law of Peoples. And to the disappointment of a lot of his readers and followers and enthusiasts, he didn't think of his two principles of justice, that equal liberties, fair equality of opportunity, and difference principle, as extending to the whole globe. He imagined a global society divided into separate peoples with different political traditions and different political aspirations. And what he thought was that you wanted to ensure that these different societies were organized in at least a decent way, but he believed that there was a kind of tolerance that you have to show at the global level, and that what you didn't want to do was win the whole world for his political liberalism, that was intolerant.
That's really fascinating. We've got a caller that may take us deeper into this question. Sue in Oakland's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Sue.
Thank you. I'm just calling to say that the Nazis were murdering fascistic thugs who overpowered innocent people, and I don't think you can call that the Jews and the Nazis being at odds with one another.
Well, they're at least at odds, Sue. I don't know. Yeah. Thanks for the comment. But
I think it's very important. I think I agree entirely with Sue's point. And I should say that, about Rawls, to, you know, kind of personalize this in a way, or to personalize it, when Rawls, as you mentioned at the top of the hour, Ken, Rawls wrote an undergraduate thesis at Princeton in 1942, which is being published by Harvard University Press this spring, about faith, sin, and community. And at the time that he wrote it, he was thinking of becoming an Episcopal minister, thinking of going to a theological seminary. He volunteered for the Army to fight in World War II and fought in the Pacific. And he explained in an essay that he wrote, not published, though it will be in this book coming out from Harvard University Press. He wrote an essay late in his life that what led him away from his orthodox, high Episcopal religious convictions were three experiences during World War II. I won't describe the two of them, but the third of these was not a direct experience, but his knowledge about the Holocaust. And he thought that he couldn't reconcile his traditional conventional religious convictions with the Holocaust. And from his earliest writing until his latest, he always described the Nazism as a hideous evil.
Right, right. And no, I don't think anybody would deny that. And so, but let's ask a question that takes this worry a little further. People do all sorts of horrible things. Yeah. And now, you said on the international level, they overall sort of argued for a kind of decency and a kind of tolerance. Suppose that a nation were as diverse as the world is. Could there be a Rawlsian state whose peoples were as divided as the peoples of the world are from each other? Or do they have to have, you know, something more in common than the nations of the world have?
That's a wonderful question. Lincoln said that our country was, as I said earlier, was conceived in an idea and dedicated to a proposition. And he said in the Gettysburg Address that it was very much an open question whether a country with a conception and a dedication of that kind could long endure.
Right.
And the point is, the country was not conceived in an ethnicity or in a tradition or in blood. It was conceived in a set of abstractions about people being about liberty and equality. And the issue about whether a single society as diverse as global society could endure is really an issue about whether a society with a kind of a set of shared principles can endure, even with a great deal of ethno-religious diversity.
Now, I understand that Rawls, after the theory of justice, political liberalism?
Yes, political liberalism, yes.
Worried a lot about this kind of issue.
Absolutely.
Right, because you might think I'm a fundamentalist Christian, right? And then let's not take somebody as divided as those two twos. Just a fundamentalist Christian and a secular humanist. The fundamentalist Christian says abortion should be outlawed because God tells me, right? And now the secular humanist says, God schmod, how are these people supposed to have political debate? I mean, they can't even decide what's a good reason for a policy. They can't have a shared view of what's a good reason for a policy.
I think there are two points there. The first thing is that I would start, it's very important not to start with the issues that divide. We know that we're divided on the abortion issue. It's been the most divisive issue in the country for 35 years. Start by asking whether the fundamentalist Christian and the secular humanist can agree on, for example, the importance of political democracy, can agree on the importance of political liberty, establish some kind of common ground of argument, and then move from there. The other thing is that there are lots of people who think that abortion is morally wrong, think that it's murder, but don't think that it ought to be that moral belief ought to be established as a matter of law. That was the position that Governor Cuomo, a Catholic, not a fundamentalist, of course, that Governor Cuomo took at Notre Dame in 1984. It's the position that Pelosi takes. It's the position that Vice President Biden takes. So you look for some common ground and don't be quick to assume that people who disagree on some things can't agree on
some
other
things. So find enough common ground in your view about what should and shouldn't be,
yes,
right, to build a political state. And it sounds like Rawls thinks you don't have to settle all ethical moral disputes in order to have a political
state.
Don't
expect too much from philosophy.
Or politics, right?
This may not be the right show
Isn't it also or politics?
And don't expect too much from politics. You have a certain sense of humility about philosophy and about the limits of politics. You have a political idea, not a religious, you know, general moral idea.
We got one last caller on the line. Mikhail in Oakland. Did I say your name right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. What's your comment or question?
My question and comment is, the Constitution of Stalin guaranteed pretty much the same things that the American Constitution guaranteed. But look at the result. And you're saying that... your guest is saying that you ultimately you will fall back on human nature to guarantee that the interpretation and the execution of the principles are in line with his vision or Rawls' vision. But there are plenty of people in Russia who today who wish that the old Soviet Union would come back, that the Russians were better under the old Soviets. So my comment is that you cannot guarantee that your interpretation will be as of these principles will be as you wish, because if the bottom line is the human nature, then whatever the broad range of people decide is correct, it would be ultimately correct.
I hope I didn't say that. But I think what we agree on here is there is no guarantee of justice. There's no substitute for the conscientious efforts of people guided by decent principles, guided by an idea of mutual respect, to try to achieve what they can achieve through common political means. And there's no guarantee of success that lies in human nature or in documents or in anything else. You have reasonable faith that the conscientious efforts are going to produce something decent.
So, Josh, let me shift gears here just a little. Political philosophy is dominated for a long time by these two Harvard guys, John Rawls, your teacher, and then Bob Nozick, who put forward kind of a libertarian view in Anarchy, State, and Utopia. Now, what I found lacking in both of those was... not lacking, but they didn't address political change and what's justified. I mean, Nozick gave us a nice picture of what the world would be like if people actually had property justly. But nobody has property justly as far as you go back in history. Right. They seized it from someone else. Rawls gave us a very nice vision of what it would be like if we set up states behind a veil of ignorance. But by and large, we don't. Even in the United States, we have this very anti-democratic institution, the U.S. Senate, so that if I were from Joe Biden's state, I would have roughly, in terms of the Senate, 500 times the political power that I do as a Californian. I don't feel I should revolt in the street or kill anybody over that. Given so many governments around the world, though, that really are so far from anything that anyone would agree to behind a veil of ignorance, What steps are philosophically justified? What philosophical principles govern whether it's okay to kill someone or blow up someone in order to bring about a change of government?
Briefly, Josh. 30 seconds.
No principles decide on that. The point of having an ideal like principles you would choose behind the veil of ignorance is to get some kind of guidance for efforts at change and reform. But they're never going to tell, they're no substitute for prudent judgment about what to do about particular laws, policies, or acts of opposition. They're just general standards of guidance. That's what philosophy is good for.
Well, on that uplifting note, Josh, I'm going to thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Our guest has been Josh Cohen, professor of political science, philosophy, and law at Stanford University, a prolific author, editor of the Boston Review, one of the busiest human beings I know, and he's paying homage to his very revered teacher, Rawls, in a forthcoming critical edition of A Brief Inquiry into the Meaning of Sin and Faith, Rawls's undergraduate senior thesis. So, John, I thought this was fascinating. I know you teach Rawls a lot. So did you learn anything new? Or?
Well, I don't teach Rawls a lot. I have taught at an introductory level, I think, Rawls, and I knew Rawls a little. We tried to lure him to Stanford at one point. He was a great man and a great philosopher. I think of going back when I started graduate school in 1964. At that point, from World War II till around then, political philosophy and indeed ethical philosophy was really in the doldrums in the U.S. It was very lively in Europe, where there were these real issues about whether the newly forming and redefining themselves states would be socialist, and there was the communist parties were active, and there were a lot of thinking. But in America, I don't know whether it was McCarthyism or self-satisfaction, there really wasn't much. That's all changed due to Rawls, due to Nozick. Yeah. Nowadays, when we look at our department with people like Josh Cohen and Deborah Zatz, political philosophy is really the most vibrant part of philosophy. Yeah, I think that's great.
I don't know if it's the most, but it's very vibrant. And I think that, you know, the logical positivists had something to do with it, too, in the decline of political philosophy and the nature of their views. But you know what? I think we could talk about Rawls for another time, because this was really fascinating stuff. But I think there's a real heart problem at the heart of it. I don't think Rawls sufficiently cope with how divided people are. Right. There are certain conditions under which these things work, when people have mutual respect and all that sort of stuff. But if you look around the world, that's a rare moment in history when a state forms like that. So I think it's really tough. But this conversation continues on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, and also check out our Facebook page, where we have this ever-growing community. Just sign up.
For the final word, we're going to pull back the veil of ignorance on Ian Scholes, the 62nd philosopher.
Ian Scholes, if we don't know who or what we are, we would be in a much better position to set up a totally equal system of justice. So claimed John Rawls, using the thought experiment premise he called a veil of ignorance, behind which we are all equal. But where do we go from there? Well, we each have basic rights to what Rawls calls primary goods, things which a rational man wants, whatever else he wants. That's the stuff like rights, shelter, food, make your own list. This leads to what is called the difference principle, as I understand it. The difference principle means that after the primary goods are acquired or distributed or whatever, somebody shouldn't have something if it makes somebody else worse off who doesn't have that thing. This quickly becomes problematic. What are those things? The right to clean air, a high-resolution television, chocolate milk? Take clown shoes, for example. Great for clowns, but does the lack of clown shoes affect a lot of, say, trial lawyers, bus drivers, or cosmetic surgeons? And now there's a new wrinkle. Colin Farrelly, in an article called The Genetic Difference Principle, written in 2004 for the American Journal of Bioethics, wrote, quote, "What should be equalized? Should we try to equalize our genetic potentials for health, height, being physically attractive, etc.? Suppose, for example, we could maximize the genetic endowments of the least advantaged in the next generation by legislating mandatory genetic screening of fetuses and, where necessary, compulsory use of prenatal genetic therapies," unquote. Well, here's a fine kettle of fish. Reading this, my mind started to reel. Where does it stop? Antidepressants, for example. Why should the rich have them and the poor not? It's much more depressing to be poor than rich, believe me. In the future, as genetic knowledge gets more sophisticated and we can either cure people with diseases or prevent the diseases in the first place, who gets the treatment? And what about enhancements? If we can use drugs or gene therapies to make ourselves smarter, stronger, happier, who gets them? Who doesn't? Who pays for it all? Should we just say the hell with it, have the veil of ignorance surgically removed, and try to live together in a Hobbesian, dog-eat-dog, libertarian hell? I don't know. Whatever happens, though, let me keep my clown shoes. Please? I gotta go.
That was Ian Scholes, digging deep, digging fast, the 62nd philosopher. Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Minella Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2008.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Our production coordinator is Devin Strolovich. Daniel Elstein is our director of research. Lael Weiss is our webmaster. Also thanks to Zoe Corneli, Merle Kessler, Corey Goldman, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Templeton Foundation.
And from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.